Reservable. It's the reservable. It's the reservable. It's the reservable. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back to the Reset Rebel podcast with me, Jo Yule, and a very happy new year to you. I'm not sure if it's too late in January to still be saying that out loud, but I'm going to do it anyway, being as this is the very first episode of 2026. It's so good to be back in your ears, and I cannot tell you the view that I'm sitting here perched on a cliff top, overlooking the swimming pool of Calicomte, overlooking also in the distance the incredibly beautiful nature reserve and private island that is, of course, Conajeras. And this is exactly the reason that we chose today's epic little vista, because our guest is a man who's lived here all of his life. He's also dipped out into the States and the UK, but he spends, or has spent, and was born here and has spent most of his life living on Ibiza, where he has his boat company, Meet the Sea. So we're going to be getting a little bit more into a sea-flavoured theme today here on the Reset Rebel, and talking about his incredible family boat trips, which basically educate children and give them a more sort of present element with their connection to the underwater ecosystems and general knowledge, and kind of, you know, making them less frightened, I guess, to enter the water. So I'm going to let Gregoria Canellas give you all the background on that. And I'm so happy to welcome him to the very first Reset Rebel podcast of 2026. Gregoria, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jo. And it's wonderful to be the first one in 2026. And so happy to be here in Calicomte. It sums up a lot of what we all look for in Ibiza. It's stunning beauty. It's incredible waters that we're seeing right now. It's incredible green. A little bit of history as well, as we see the fishing huts that are just perched on the cliffs there. They used to be the home of the small wooden boats where they date about 100, 150 years ago, roughly, the older ones. And this is where farmers used to stow away their small wooden boat where they would go fishing on Sundays. And nowadays, some of them still keep it there. But a lot of families have been very happy to receive this as their heritage and use it to make a wonderful family reunion on Sundays where they cook. You often see them with chimneys where they all get together. There are all kinds of toys in there. And it's a wonderful piece of property to have.
I mean, obviously housing is a massive issue in Ibiza, so I can see a little bit of disparity there like that exists in the rest of the island. Someone's got a slightly sort of upstaged his neighbours. Can you describe that for us?
Yes, we see that in one of them. Somebody went for the duplex option. And we see two levels there where you have the typical access to the water where the boat would be. And then on top, they've proceeded to build a little bit more.
And a penthouse.
A bit of a penthouse, yes. And of course, with the beautiful views of, as you were mentioning before, the nature reserve of Conillera in Ibicenco, or Conejera Island, which is a wonderful short island, about 3 kilometers. And this is where we go daily in the summer between May and the end of October to do our family boat trip that we've now been doing for 6 years. And that really makes me very happy that my experience in Ibiza, which is having grown up here and spent a lot of summers and winter Christmas holidays and Easter holidays, and always, even if I was living in the US or in England, it was home to me. It was the place where I met my family. It was the place that made me return to the sea, which has always been of great importance to me. And I hope, especially through Meet the Sea, that the work that we do on a daily basis in the summer with children and adults as well will be very important.
I think let's sort of start really then with, you know, I'm sure you really missed the sea here when you were in England and when you were spending time in the States and obviously working over there. I mean, you know, How would you describe what we've got here right in front of us, the Balearic Sea? What is, you know, this is absolutely pristine, crystalline, magnificent, spectacular, gorgeous waters that we're seeing in front of us. I mean, what is, you know, what does the Balearic Sea specifically mean to you?
I think it's an opportunity is what I see the most. I think that the history of tourism in Spain has been one of building another club, another hotel, entertainment, pure entertainment. But I think we've overlooked the importance of education and becoming sort of an ocean classroom for Europe. I think that we have things that are overlooked sometimes in Ibiza. Incredible biodiversity, not just the beauty and the color of the waters, but what happens under them. And this is not just something to enjoy, which obviously our boat trip, for instance, is a celebration of sea and family, where being in ideal, beautiful location like the nature reserve of Conillera is. But it's also about what it gives us at an emotional and educational level. So many days during the summer, I encounter situations where children are afraid of the sea. Two reasons mainly. Sharks and the film Jaws did a lot of harm there. I think we are in a generation where children right now know about the sea, but mostly through screens. And if we think about the publicity that the sea sometimes gets, it's one of the unknown. Even historically, when you look at maps, it tended to be the case that you had the depiction of the land and then the sea with drawings of monsters as the unknown, the scary ocean. And to a certain extent, this still happens today. Children are afraid of jellies, of sharks and other sea creatures. I get this question all the time on the way out as they board. First questions from children, are there going to be sharks? Are there going to be jellies? The interesting thing is that I always get these questions on the way out, but not once in 700 boat trips have I had that question asked on the way back. And this says something about actually getting in the water, growing as a person, developing their self-confidence, being proud of what they just achieved. There's a little bit of a swimming pool syndrome at the moment. Those whose parents take them to wonderful hotels with splendid swimming pools, but it's a bit restrictive. You see mom and dad at all times. It's normally shallow. The distance you cover is limited. And that comfort, well, it can be good in the beginning to make you become a confident swimmer, makes them particularly afraid of being in open waters. And this is one of the things that we try to correct, to help them in that transition from swimming pool to sea, and to not view the ocean as something scary, but something that actually makes them grow.
So obviously you're very passionate about this idea of sharing, you know, the underwater ecosystems and, you know, the ability to educate children through their connection to the water. And I think, you know, what you've said is absolutely true. You know, most children experience the sea through a screen, and here we have a little boat pulling into this beautiful bay you can hear in the background. But I think it's also, you know, the reason it's probably less frightening than a lot of other places in the world is because it's such good visibility. You know, the reason you can see, I would say, looking at the water today, I would say the visibility is probably like 1 millimeter. You can see it's like glass, basically. It's absolutely fantastic. And that is of course, due to the Posidonia, which is obviously, you know, the underwater ecosystem that's ancient and has been there for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years and breathes life into the water. So, you know, we have a very unique system that kind of makes this particular water network, I guess, you know, more accessible to the kind of work that you really want to do here, which makes it very special.
Absolutely. On any given day, we see, first off, as soon as we drop anchor, making sure that we never drop anchor near Posidonia, but these amazing meadows of Posidonia, a habitat that is a UNESCO protected heritage in Ibiza. And that it really is the lung of the sea that provides clarity, that doesn't actually filter the waters, but through its oxygen production, what it does is clear and clean the waters. It's also the home of so many different creatures that protect themselves and feed themselves, being in the Posidonia or Neptune grass, as it's known in English. And we're very lucky to have these all surrounding the island. They also, what they do is, one of the reasons we don't suffer so much from erosion in the sandy beaches is because they act as a natural stop for winter waves. And it sort of mollifies and softens the effect of the wave that by the time it arrives into the sand is already a lot softer. So we have that advantage as well through the Posidonia. But going back to your question about biodiversity and what we're able to see in this wonderful sea is the fact that it is not so difficult if you snorkel for a little while and know what to look for to find starfish, octopuses. You can also see sea cucumbers, sea tomatoes, sea breams, salimas, painted combers, wrasses. The variety is really stunning and colorful. And going back to making children confident at sea, I think the sheer attraction and how mesmerized they are when they see these creatures.
Exactly what you've just said right there. I mean, when I had the extreme fortune, because you invited me to come and join your boat trip in the summer, I mean, I have never seen a seahorse. And that is one of the things that you pointed out to us, I believe, on that boat trip. And I've always wanted to see one. And I think, you know, I just think it's so amazing when you spot something like that, that you've obviously seen in books or heard about or seen in films or seen on, you know, footage through screens, as you said, but to actually have that physical connection, you know, visually to it by actually finding it here in my own local natural habitat was, you know, a really, really special moment. And I think just the way that you do that boat trip and the way that you kind of, you know, roll out the books and the, you know, the pictures of all of that and sort of have the information there for people to dip into on the way out is really important for them to, you know, see it and then obviously be able to identify it when they are under the water where you obviously can't talk to them. So, it's, you know, it's an amazing thing that you're doing there. I really, really love that.
Thank you. I think that the biodiversity element is very important. Their ability to interact and see species, it makes them immediately so much more comfortable. The other one is more of a psychological aspect. We're now working with, it's been now a year that we've been working with Oxford University students where Meet the Sea popped the question, you know, sea and psychology, what's been studied, what's been researched, what's the evidence of the benefits of the sea to the human mind? And while we are now preparing a boat trip for next year, for this next summer, starting in May, in conjunction with Ivory Wang, who's a student, Masters of Philosophy, 2-year program in Oxford. And she's been wonderful doing research and providing evidence and how to prepare a trip that will be concentrating on the psychological benefits of the sea and how to improve your well-being, your self-confidence and your personal development through it. I think that that second aspect is one that we has been vastly underutilized and misinterpreted sometimes. It's to what extent our mind benefits from interaction with the sea. I say this as I've just been swimming, as I do pretty much every day in the winter, which I, you know, waters only get to a low of 14 degrees, which is, you know, very standard temperatures.
You're a brave man. I definitely, I won't be going in 14 degrees. I can tell you that for nothing.
But I can tell you that this is already the second reason of doing Meet the Sea. A lot of it has to do with my upbringing near the sea and the importance of family moments and the joys that it's given me. But there's also a professional element as I became very involved with finance in London and had a very stressful job there as a trader for many years. The sea was often an escape that I would use on weekends to restore equilibrium, inner peace. It's sort of a spiritual healing, if you want to. And I think that as one gets older, and this is why Meet the Sea is not only for children, as I think of adults, for those that have the opportunity to be near the sea on a frequent basis, even if it's only just a getaway for a weekend, the interaction of sea and water will refill your batteries for quite a long time. And I think that this is something that's sometimes overlooked, and but the impact is fantastic.
Well, you look very suntanned and very outdoorsy, may I say, and very healthy and fit. So I'm quite jealous, actually, that you get to spend every single day.
Too.
Well, thank you so much. But, you know, you do. You look a picture of health. And I think, you know, that definitely comes from daily dipping, which I'm absolutely, you know, petrified of doing myself in the wintertime. I'm a little bit, you know, I'm a fair weather friend. That's obviously the reason I live in Ibiza, because I don't like the cold of England. But, you know, I've even got like a full blown wetsuit, bodysuit, you know, it's a long suit. And I just, yeah, maybe I need to get some booties and a hat. Maybe then I could get in.
I think whatever it takes to feel comfortable. I think you'd probably find that after a few times of using your wetsuit, you'll say, I don't need it. I want more contact with the sea. There's something about these not cold, but certainly refreshing water temperatures at the moment. It does have an impact on how you feel right after it. You feel a lot more relaxed, a lot more than a swimming pool can give you. And I say this when I wasn't in Ibiza, I used swimming pools a lot. I think it's in general the water or the blue effect, as it's called, or the blue mind. There's been abundant research on this field. I think any form of water is positive. But I think that the sea and the sea salt does a lot to you. And I actually prefer the colder temperatures of winter.
I agree with you. I remember when I was in Thailand doing my advanced diving course. And I mean, I didn't know it at the time, but I had malaria and I was feeling feverish and my tummy was upset and I felt absolutely shocking, as you would do if you had malaria. But I had no idea that I had it. So I was, you know, continuing on with my diving course. And the only time during the day I felt good was when I was in the sea. I had no upset tummy. I had no issues with my digestive system. That was definitely one of the main symptoms. And the feverishness and the general sense of, you know, dis-ease, if you will, was just gone as soon as I got in the water. And particularly when I was under it, I never felt any problems at all.
I think in Ibiza, one common situation is that hangover. And I think there's the best cure, and much better than a swimming pool, is to immediately go into the sea and you feel 10 times better. I'm sure that a lot of people know that.
I used to swim on the 1st of May when I lived in Brighton. I mean, that's not for the faint-hearted. I used to go in, come hell or high water, and it was, you know, you go in and you just get that completely numb, your whole body. And the pain was, you know, it was quite something to have to try and get through that little moment. But as you said, as you come out, the tingling starts. And sometimes I could be tingling for maybe 2 or 3 hours, even all the way on the train up to London to go to work. If I swam in the morning, I'd be tingling for about 3 or 4 hours. It sounds ridiculous. But my whole body was like literally sort of like electrified, you know, like for 3 or 4 hours in the aftermath.
Absolutely. Not you, because you're a very young person, but, you know, for somebody my age, I really think that the interaction with the sea can be such a positive effect on your mind. I really think that staying away from, aside from the fact that I think it makes you stronger, and I've had less colds than I've ever had in my life, I think it makes your immune system stronger. I think it makes you a more positive person, and keeps you away from antidepressants and other things and stimulus. Not coincidentally, I think, and this is just a personal experience, and I'm not claiming any medical evidence to this, but the truth is that I haven't had a drink in 2 years now. And this was not something that I set out to do. Not at all. It's true that when I was in finance in London, there used to be this dry month of January, so I had the experience of not drinking for a whole month. But it just so happened that over the years being here amid the sea and spending 6 months in the water at a clip of 4 hours roughly every day in the sea, that somehow alcohol just didn't fit in my life. It's not what my body was asking for. And it's something that came in a very natural way. And I like to believe, and again, I don't know that there's evidence of this, but at least in my personal experience, this constant interaction with the water sustained through the year made me adopt much healthier habits in general. And I don't think it's unrelated to the frequency of swimming.
I think it's to do with the connection. You know, when you're connected to nature, you're connected to you, because we are one, right? And ultimately, I think the more connected you become to the ground that we came from, essentially, in some capacity, we don't need to go down that rabbit hole. But I think ultimately, you know, more connection to Mother Nature and the external world that she's created makes us much more, you know, connected to our own selves. I mean, when you get in the water and you put on a mask or you put on a diving suit or whatever you do, you know, the first thing you notice is your breath, because you can hear it audibly, you know, way more than when you're above the water. And it makes you really take notice, I think, about how you're breathing and the way you're breathing. And if you're breathing into a regulator on a dive, then you're really listening to every breath you take, and you're trying not to breathe too hard or too fast, because you don't want to use up all your air. It's the same snorkeling. You know, I really notice, like, if I'm panting and if I'm stressed, and then suddenly my breaths become longer and longer and longer and longer until I'm, like, you know, practically floating. I'm hardly breathing at all, seemingly, because you do just become, you know, so much more calm. And I think that's also the drinking thing as well, because, you know, what's the number one thing that people reach for when they're feeling stressed is probably a drink or a cigarette, I would say, you know. And I think when you're not so stressed, you don't really probably want to drink as much at the end of a day, just to sort of switch off and tap out of that kind of stressful feeling.
That's very interesting why you say that, because it also makes me think that that insulation, that protection, that awareness of yourself and how you feel when you're at sea is even different at different moments of the day. When I enter the water, typically around 10 in the morning, as we set drop anchor in Conaira Island, it's a completely different experience from swimming at sunset, for instance, in which the texture of the water and the moment to yourself feels completely different. You cannot compare the sensation, the feelings, and how your mind feels from being in the water in the morning, midday, under the strong sun, or in the peace of sunset. And more in general, it, as you were speaking now about the importance of our interaction with the sea, it just reminded me, and it wasn't long ago, I think it was a couple of months ago, that I read something by someone who's very much in the position to make comments about this, and that's Sir David Attenborough, who's, you know, only 100 years old and has been doing documentaries for the BBC for the past 40. And it was after his series on oceans, and he said that really he felt personally that the future of our planet, of our race, will be largely dictated by the health and strength of our relationship with the oceans. Not a surprise. It is 2/3 of the planet. It is the big unknown. I think we know more about the moon than we know about certain parts of the ocean. But I think we need to be much more aware of the importance that the sea is going to play. And I'm very happy that he underlined this, because I think he's completely spot on, and a very trustworthy figure to take it from. Yes.
I think old Mr. Attenborough, Sir David Attenborough, actually, if we're going to give him his full title, is definitely onto something there. I mean, there's no denying, you know, that basically when we are protecting the Posidonia and we are creating, just as we've seen a boat literally arrive during the course of this conversation, you know, he's in the middle of that beautiful swimming pool, as you refer to, over there, and he's not dropped his anchor on any of the darker patches, which is of course where the Posidonia is.
Yes,
so,
well,
you know,
then
10 out of 10 for Mr. What's his face over there for not dropping anchor on the Posidonia, because he totally would have grassed you up, no pun intended. And I think ultimately, you know, protecting the underwater ecosystems and making sure that the biodiversity thrives and not just survives is in turn, you know, making sure that we also thrive and not just survive, because ultimately the Posidonia, you know, equates to more effectivity in terms of breathing oxygen into the air than the entirety of the rainforest on planet Earth, which of course is, you know, a physical entity on the land. So, you know, ultimately it kind of offsets a lot of the flights that come in here through the busy season in the summer, which of course, you know, if you stand on the edge of Dalt Villa and you look up into the sky in the summer and count 60 seconds, they are literally coming in one a minute in such utter frequency. It is outrageous, really. But I would say our kind of, you know, reset button is the Posidonia, which kind of, you know, they call it the, what do they call it? The blue carbon that we have that exists. And I think, you know, the sea really sucks a lot of the pollution out of the air and basically forgives us for all of the madness and chaos that we personally create. And of course, the boat system in Ibiza becomes, you know, it's very magical here now. We've got one boat in front of us. But in the summer, I mean, how many boats do you think would be in this bay?
Oh, I think we really, I counted them this summer as we dropped anchor, but we saw in the distance probably about 40 or 50 of them. I think that the majority of them, I think, are more aware than, say, 20 years ago about what is allowed and what is not. So I think there's an evolution in the awareness from the local government in Ibiza that's done a fairly strong job in making sure that that people behave responsibly when they own a boat and what they do with it at sea. I think also we interact daily with the guardians of the and the guards of the nature reserve of Conejera, who always address boats that are dropping their anchor in Neptune Grass and Posidonia not to do so. Unfortunately, they cannot penalize boats, and they haven't been given the power. It's only a warning that they do, that most boat owners heed when they're given it. But I think in general, and just outside Ibiza, I think that I'm a bit confused by the current narrative of schools in general, not specifically, not just in England, the US, in Europe, everywhere. We talk about the importance of the oceans. We talk about the future of the planet. But it seems to me that it is egregiously missing throughout the formative years to have a closer relationship to the sea via theory and via experiences. I was very happy to host the first Meet the Sea school trip, a sea trip, as we call it, because ski trips are everywhere and clearly institutionalized and present everywhere. However, the sea trip is a lot less present. And I think while I love skiing and the mountain and the mountains, I think that what a sea trip gives you is not only joy and fun, but also an awareness of sustainability and our role as humans as fundamental. And so King Edward VI High School for Girls from Birmingham came and visited us for 5 days in the last month of May. And we organized for them day and afternoon, 4 hours each, a total of 8 activities that they did over the 4 days, completely sea related. And they did, they were wonderful. They did paddle surfing, sailing with the Club Náutico of San Antonio, did a bit of kayaking and paddle surfing with Toby Clark, who organized a wonderful activity for them.
He's been on his podcast about
5,000 times. Yes, he has. I did listen to it.
Heart.
Yes. And he did a wonderful introductory activity in the port of San Miguel with them. We also did an underwater drone or ROV class for them, where students were aware of the advances in technology that allows you, for instance, to see the Posidonia from very up close with a remotely operated vehicle. And in general, we had the feedback of these 40 students of 5 teachers that came with them that it was a great school. They were nice enough on their Instagram account to say that it was the best school trip that the school had ever organized. And I think a lot of it is because some of these girls, as they later said on their testimonials, some of them suffer from thalassophobia. Some of them were just not comfortable at sea. And it was incredible to see the progress that they made in 4 days. From the Monday they arrived until the Friday that they left, a lot of them with tears in their eyes. They enjoyed everything from swimming Calaconta to all the aforementioned activities. And it made me particularly happy to see that an institution as good as that one shared our view of the importance of exposing children to the sea. They were all between 13 and 17 years of age. And while some of them were very comfortable from the start, others did have to go through a transitional period, both physical and mental, to become more comfortable at sea. And again, that goes back to the wonderful Ibiza setting, wonderful sunny days where they felt just so comfortable embracing these activities and becoming more whole as a person, I think.
No, for sure. I mean, it's definitely a thing. I mean, literally we're sitting here, there's another lady just getting undressed, looking like she's about to get in the water. And I'm actually listen to this conversation, just thinking, I really want to get in.
Right after,
like, why didn't I bring my swimsuit? Although, actually, do you know what? I did. It is in the car, and I do have a towel. This is. I'm thinking. Seeing as you're a native, like, why does everyone get naked on this island? Why is it such a thing? Why is it like, I mean, I've never ever even gone topless before I moved to Ibiza, and suddenly living here, I must admit, I have. Oh no, she's not going in, she's jumping in that boat. Is he like a taxi service, or what's going on there? Maybe he's a drug dealer.
No, it looks quite official. It's uniformed as well.
It does.
They do carry out quite a few works in the off-season on making sure of the coast limits, measurements.
Have you ever found any drugs, Grigori? You've been here for a long time.
No, I have not. I can't say that I have. And I was reading the newspaper. I found this box. I found this other box. But no.
Did you find a box of treasure?
It's not been.
Are you sure? Because there was a captain on board your ship, like a pirate captain. I was like, maybe the pirate found a box of gold.
Well, unfortunately, the closest we've come to the treasure is the treasure chest ourselves that we have on our boat that's full of candy. But candy for children.
That'll do. I'm right on the sugar at the moment because I am doing dry January. And I tell you what, sugar is my new friend at the minute. So that'll do for treasure. But I mean, what else have you seen? All these years of swimming in the water and all these years of, you know, being on board the boat and going out to Conejera. What annoys you the most about summertime, about people's behaviour on the sea, if we're going to name and shame?
Every day I pick up the most incredible variety of objects from the bottom of the sea. And mind you, we go all the time to the same place, to Conejera Island, and I found even a car battery that I picked up. I don't even know how it got there. Towels, cups, so many things on a daily basis. The plastic that I find and we collect on a daily basis. And then I ask children to please stuff their bathing suits with whatever they find. And unfortunately, every day we come back to the boat with a substantial amount. Two reasons. First of all, things that get swept off the boats because people are not careful, with a little bit of wind, and they don't bother to pick it up. And then the awareness. We're in an island. Anything that falls off your table will probably end up in the sea. There needs to be a lot more awareness of, and there's been some improvement, the smoke-free beaches, people not leaving cigarette butts, but I still see sometimes behaviors that are completely anachronistic. I think we're in 2026, and by now we should have an awareness of the protection of the planet higher than what I see sometimes. And it pains me to see that. On the positive side, very often we see dolphins swimming near us, and that's an incredible thing. They like about our boat that we go very slowly, that is very rhythmic, that is not noisy, and that makes them feel comfortable. They're not so happy with jet skis that go very fast, make a very strong noise, and they change course constantly. And so they prefer then to stay underwater. I recently saw something that's not as common. It was a swordfish, a very large swordfish, jumping in between the waves and falling back in and playing and having fun. This was near Punta Galera. But in general, it never ceases to amaze me. I used to, when I was a kid, look for octopus and catch them. Now I'm just happy watching them. But it never ceases to amaze me and to see the face of children when I point them out and show them, see, this is the little wall of pebbles that they collect with their tentacles and they place right in front of the hole where they live. And the reason is because the moment that somebody comes, a predator or a human comes too close, what they do is with one or two of their tentacles, they're able to stick the arms to the little 12 or 20 pebbles they put together and then retrieve into the hole. And you have a wall that keeps you from reaching it. And I always like to admire the intelligence and handiness of octopus. Starfish we see very often, but other creatures that children don't really know, like the sea urchin and its different colors and how they protect themselves from the sun. They really don't like the sun, and they like to put seaweed on top and seashells to protect themselves, like we use a hat. It's incredible to be able to share with other people these habits that to the naked eye we wouldn't be able to understand why they're doing it. And I think it's a great lesson for life. Never judge by appearances. You know, understand why. It's always easier to criticize than it is to understand. And the sea sends you a lot of messages for teenagers. For instance, the sea is something that you have to enjoy, but do so carefully. And I think that risk assessment is one thing that the sea asks you to do on a daily basis. And I think that for teenagers, assessing risk is something that not always comes hand in hand with that age. And I think the impact on them is also very positive. I think the sea has something for all ages. Messages to understand.
I think while we're on the topic of messages, actually, I'm just recalling a conversation I had with Carlos Matarei, who we've discussed when we get together on a quite frequent basis, as we do tend to do over coffee. Definitely not wine these days. I think, you know, he told me when I interviewed him on this podcast that there was a moment, you know, back in the 70s when obviously, you know, people were leaving notes for each other on each other's doors and there was no, you know, there was no phones and there was no real sense of connectivity in the way, obviously, we have it now. And, you know, he was swimming out into the sea as he did on a daily basis back then. And suddenly, you know, he saw this plastic bottle. And I think he just had this kind of real visionary glimpse into the future where he realized that this was going to be a real problem. And down the line, and he decided to have a party, I think, which he called Funeral for the Sea. And everybody had to come in black and dress up as a dead sea animal or dead sea related themed person. And he did that like way back in the 70s. Yes. And I think like that was a very interesting thing that he did. And I think maybe we should rebirth that on your boat one day as a little act of protest, perhaps.
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that. It was actually called Funeral por el Mediterráneo. Yes, funeral for the Mediterranean. And not only did he ask people to do that, he also filled up the swimming pool, the then coup, with plastic bags. And yes, it was. He's a very intelligent man. He's one of the best ambassadors we could possibly have in the island. He lived everything from the golden years of Ibiza in the 60s, where he really lived the experience of being in Ibiza at that time and imbuing it with all the personality that the Ibiza now has. It begins there. I do recall how the fact, one thing that he mentions very often, that nobody called him Carlos. They called him Blue Eyes because people didn't want to know each other by names or label people in any way. Interaction was very natural. And yes, I think that act of intelligence, of seeing where we could potentially be headed if we weren't careful, was very well symbolized by this party that he organized at coup.
I mean, the guy was one of the first people to bring over a plane load of people. I think even before Pasha was, you know, alive and kicking in the way it is now, you know, more than 50 years ago. And I think that's kind of like a, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg? I wonder what would have happened if he'd never brought over that first plane load of people. What do you think? I mean, obviously, you've been here for that length of time. What do you think the island would have become if it didn't become a party island?
I think it was inevitable, more than a party island, that it became a melting pot. Let's not forget that the first visitors to the island were mainly the ones that really contributed to making Ibiza an international spot were the draft dodgers, American children trying to not be enlisted for the Vietnam War. And they were the first ones to come with their Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin records under the arm. And, well, they tended to go always up north in the island because that was the place where there was less police at the time during the dictatorship in Spain. It was very much frowned upon to have long hair and to dress that way, and to do so in Ibiza or in San Antonio, where there was more of a society or police around, was the reason why they went up north. There they were able to interact with farmers and be able to rent homes at decent prices. And I think the Las Dalias, I always think of Juanito and the wonderful work that he does in Las Dalias, the example of how it all started. This Las Dalias in the 50s was just a place where people organized locals, organized, you know, communions and birthdays. And then suddenly one day, one of these American kids arrived with the records and played that to the astonishment of the locals. But that, there was the seed planted of interaction and of music in the island and of different influences and personal stories coming in. I think that that combined with the fact that Ibiza in the time in Spain was the only place that was forgotten by the dictatorship of Franco, allowed a certain breath of fresh air, of mixture, of liberty, of freedom, that became the DNA of Ibiza still today. And I think that then obviously the role of music is the one that dictated and kept the identity. I think visionaries like Ricardo Urge or Pepe Rosselló and others that were in the island in smaller establishment but equally important, I think perpetuated the spirit of music and beyond that of celebration of different nationalities, giving Ibiza the personality that it's today known for. And of course, I have to mention Smilja Mihajlović as well, a wonderful woman that I was fortunate to know when as a youngster, and who was the creator of the ad-lib fashion. And as she always said, dress as you like, but do it with style. And she was exactly that, a very stylish woman that again was able to capture that feeling of freedom, of simplicity, of not following any particular trend, but really establishing self in how you dress and fortifying and strengthening your own identity by dressing a certain way in that freestyle. I think I think there were a few people that captured very well a certain intelligent, generous personalities are able to create a vision and from there influence your surroundings. And Ibiza, I think, has always benefited from having a number of people around that really were important in deciding where the island would go in a very involuntary manner, in a very natural way. I think that's what people my age, I'm 57 by the way, and I remember being in the Hostal da Torre, which is a hostel that my grandmother built in 64, and I spent most of my years playing in the corridors in the hallways of the 18 rooms of the hotel. To me, it was just fascinating. Clients that would come would be from university teachers to divers to hippies playing their guitar. I mean, it was so varied what I saw there. And that I think it marked me for life in understanding respect for other people, respect for other nationalities, ways of thinking, ways of looking at life.
It's always fascinating to me that people that are from here always sort of tend to have a little spell elsewhere, but they always seem to come to the realisation that there's nowhere better to be on planet Earth than here. I mean, I was just chatting to Willie Graff, a DJ and music curator on the island, and an artist. And he was, you know, he spent a lot of time in the States, and he was just like, you know, there isn't anywhere better than here. You can always think the grass is greener. I mean, I've been here for almost 13 years now, I think 13 years in March. And, you know, even leaving still crosses my mind from time to time. There's obviously things that I see elsewhere, or, you know, this feeling of, I don't know, I wouldn't say more interactive community, but a different type of community. Obviously a lot more culture. That a lot of people talk about elsewhere, or history, or all these things that sometimes we're lacking perhaps here a little bit in the winter, but I think it's become so much more, you know, so much less lacking in the last decade since I've been here. There is more community here in the winter. There is more sense of culture. There's things like TEDx Ibiza popping up. You've got, you know, all these different conferences that I'd never even heard of before, like the Ibiza Tech Forum, or, you know, there's a lot of people wanting to, I think, you know, do more like talks and sort of educate and dip into the history. There's a lot of people that want to learn here, and that's because they moved here from somewhere else and they really want to educate themselves. And I think that's really changed a lot in the last decade. I mean, what was the difference that you saw between when you left and when you came back again?
I think the winters were dark. And while that was a wonderful break for the island, and I'm always happy when the island gets a little bit of a break from the abuse it suffers during the 6 months of summer. I think that the infrastructure, I'm talking right now about schools, even about hospitals, that was missing. what I'm particularly glad to see is that that spirit that we were talking about alternative lifestyle that first came through music and fashion, now has continued. People identify Ibiza with an alternative way and a place to think and give birth to new thoughts and new initiatives. And not because you're here, but you really are a clear example of this, developing new ideas, of contacting people that bring new concepts to the island, attracted by this. I honestly don't think it's just the partying. No, I really do think that it's because people feel that Ibiza is a great place where different alternative ideas for mainstream will be accepted and listened to. And I think that this is a sort of like a second wave or generation after the originals in the 60s that have given this second wind to Ibiza in all the things that you mentioned. And I think it's a wonderful development. And the best promise of the future for the island is precisely this very much settled international place of exchange. Music perhaps leading the way, but now ideas also doing the same thing. And I think it's a wonderful thing for Ibiza to have been. I would trace this back to the beginning of the century that this began to happen, and now it's in full force, and I think it's a wonderful thing.
I mean, I asked you a minute ago, you know, what would you see Ibiza becoming if it hadn't become a music connected island? And I, you know, you look at sort of Formentera is definitely, you know, okay, it's got one tiny little club Tipic, I think it's called. It used to have a patcher there and a few other bits and bobs, but predominantly it is a farming island, and so is Menorca, and Mallorca is definitely sort of, you know, mostly I would say a kind of winery type island, and of course farming as well. But I would say, you know, of course, you've got the tourism industry there just as much as you do here. But the other ones, I would say less so. Of course, you know, all of those have that in the summer. But ultimately, they're all quite rustic, you know, quite family, farmy, you know, simple trade type places. And I think that, you know, obviously Balearic Day is coming up in March. And it's, you know, one of those days where obviously the Balearics got its independence, I believe. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. And I think one of the keys to the success of the islands in general, the Balearic Islands, is that it has been able to maintain its identity. In fact, I see more than ever now, and I'm thinking of Ibiza since we're here specifically, but also in Mallorca as well. Every small village has their holidays and their days. San Antonio's is coming up right now since we are in Calaconta. And the number of events that take place during the winter is mesmerizing. It is very hard not to have a look at any guide or look at your calendar and say, all right, there's this going on this weekend. And I think that when you look at different areas like gastronomy, I'm so proud of the number of chefs that have, you know, revitalized traditional Ibizenco cuisine. I think that Ibiza is more proud than ever of its heritage. And it's really showing it through constant events through the year of all that has been its history. And I think that that's something when I was younger wasn't as present, perhaps because the focus of Ibiza wasn't there yet. But now it is wonderful to see people who come in the winter, visitors who come in the winter are able to see a bit more of the local folklore or history of Ibiza. And I'm glad to see that a lot of people are very interested in it. They generally want to know more about the traditional and life of the islanders.
Why is it that each of the little towns do have their own little party? I mean, it literally is endless, isn't it? There's always a public holiday here, which I love. And, well, sometimes I don't love it if I really need to go shopping. But, you know, if I'm not organised enough to remember when they are, it can be quite distressing. But ultimately, it's a great thing that each of these little hamlets or whatever, you know, little pueblos have their own little party. Like, I think the Portinach one is in the summer. They have a big old party on the beach. They have a DJ. They have a stage. And as you said, it's San Antonio's turn this weekend. So, I mean, what is that? Why does each town? I mean, does this come out of our taxes? Are we paying for this? Should we know more about it? Well, how many beers can we have on Dry January at the government's expense?
Obviously, at the outset of all this is the profoundly religious tradition. It's always attached to the name of the saint of the village and on the calendar date. We have to understand that when this started, the church was the center and the place of reunion for all farmers and families that would have their homes disseminated across the few miles away from the church. And this was an opportunity to get together and celebrate in what was for many, many years a very poor island. And so this was something that was very much circled in the calendar. And there's a lot of literature regarding this, which I'm a big fan of. I think that nowadays this tradition continues. Now we have the rice competition in San Antonio in February. I think it's February 7th. I think that so much of it, it really is the fiber, and it is really the people who live in Ibiza who celebrate this and compete, for instance, in this with their own recipes. There's such a level of enthusiasm of celebrating who we are, who they are, and how they live, and the understanding of life. And I think it's wonderful that it happens in the winter, because during the summer it would be impossible for most, as everybody's busy.
Just to see who can make the best paella, or to see who can eat the most paella.
Well, it's not paella. It's actually different types of rice. So there's a certain freedom of deciding what the rice would be. But this, I don't know, I think maybe 40 or 50 different stands, and it's just a great day of tasting everything and having good laugh with very good musical performances as well. It's just a great day out, but this extends to San Carlos. There was the calamar or the squid one happening.
Love that festival. That's my favorite. That's a really good one. Much rather overdose on calamari than 50 different types of rice. I think that's a recipe for food coma.
There's also the one in Santa Eulalia with the jarret, which is a very small fish that's caught in April, and they do they bring tons of it.
That's also, yeah, that's in my hometown. That is actually, I lied. San Carlos comes in second. Santa Eulalia, don't have to drive anywhere. I can walk down to the bottom of my hill and be right in the thick of it within about 60 seconds from my front door. It's amazing. And all of these wonderful little winter secrets that you've just shared, well, hopefully no one will remember them, but it is, you know, there's just ridiculous amounts of brilliance going on here in the winter. And it's, yeah, it is amazing to see how the island has evolved, as I said, even in just the decade or, you know, 13 years that I've been here. And actually, when I was driving down, I always forget the name of it. So I can never Google it or remember the name of the restaurants because I go there so infrequently. But I drove past the turning to one of my favorite places on the whole island that I barely ever go. I think I've only ever been there like three times. I don't generally tend to get down to this neck of the woods very often, so thank you for the invitation. But I drove past the turning to San Agustí. I love it in there. It is so cute. There are these two, well, one particularly awesome restaurant and that gorgeous church, and there's sort of, and they have bunting. I love a bit of bunting. It's very British in my mind, even though it's not. It's probably Spanish, but who knows. And, you know, it's just a real sense of sort of very festive kind of rusticity in there that I really, really love. And the food is very good at that slightly less fancy restaurant. What's the name of that one?
Well, there's Camberry Bay, and then there's the bar right across from the church, and they make a wonderful barbecue there.
That's the one.
And I think the setting is fantastic. It has a beautiful view of rural Ibiza, of the algarrobos and olive trees and almond trees that are just in the little flat in front of San Agustín. I think it's a wonderful location. It's near the Atalaya of San Jose, so it gets a little bit more water and humidity, so it tends to be a very fertile and full of flower valley. Now we're in January, and thanks to the wonderful rains that we had in December, I'm always happy when it rains in Ibiza. We have right now a countryside that is the most stunning I've seen in years. And always in Ibiza, there is this beginning of spring that, to me, really begins to be suggested in the countryside as soon as days begin to become longer. So precisely around the 22nd of December, when days come at its lowest of day sun hours, and then it begins to go the other way, you begin to feel in nature that things are rejuvenating, they are being born again, and that spring is just around the corner. To me, spring in Ibiza begins the first week of January. Perhaps I attach it a little bit to the wonderful almond trees blossoms when we see in the Valley of Corona. all that wonderful spectacle. Unfortunately, right now, and I was just in a bar that I had driven by, Casferre. Casferre is about a kilometer away from the Church of Santa Ines, and I'd never stopped there. And I said, today is the day. And it truly is one of those jewels only for locals and farmers that are around. I've never seen other cars that park there. And I spoke to the man behind the bar who's owned the business for many years, and he was talking about the almond trees. And unfortunately, they have a disease right now, Xylella, it's called, sort of like a little red worm that has unfortunately killed most of the almond trees. And I went outside and I started snapping little branches from most of the almond trees, and they're gone. They're completely dry, and I doubt we will see much of a spectacle this year. Unfortunately, there's no cure for it.
Is that the same one that gets the palm trees?
It's a different one. It's a different disease, but unfortunately, they've become... We're living through an era that's difficult. We had the snakes coming in the olive trees from the south of Spain when everybody wanted to buy olive trees and we didn't check what was inside them. Then we had the same thing with the palm trees as the picudo. I don't know what it is in English, but it's a different animal to the one that's right now in almond trees. And there were wonderful initiatives from people to replant more almond trees. Unfortunately, it really... The only cure that there is right now comes from complete eradication and beginning from zero again. So unless the epidemic itself decides to leave on its own, but it could be here for years. Unfortunately, there's very little. It really talks about the limits of humans and how much we can affect our own destiny. Because some of these things, there's nothing much we can do. Some of the things we can do better to protect ourselves. And... in case of the olive trees, for instance, you know, buying trees without seeing what's inside, well, you know, that shouldn't happen. We've learned the hard way.
I think, yeah, you know, hopefully there's going to be blossom for many years to come on this island. But yes, the proof shall be in the blossom pudding. Can we finish on the majesty, the majesticness of Conajera in the distance? Because I can see... a lighthouse, and of course, Conajera means rabbit in Spanish. And maybe you could just, you know, as we gaze over this for the final few moments, just talk us through why it is that you chose to take the boat trip there and a little bit about that island.
I think, first of all, it was nostalgia a little bit. It's the lighthouse that I used to fall asleep to, the reflection of the light in my bedroom in Cap Negret. And how happy I felt and safe in my bed when I knew that the lighthouse was on. Then memories of going there with the boat at the time where you could still cook a paella there, and that we had to cook it there and then eat it standing up, because otherwise the lizards would jump into your plate. So we always did that. But the fantastic biodiversity is the main reason why I went there. The lighthouse was built in mid-19th century. 1850 something. I still knew the guy that lived there permanently because he was in charge of turning it on and off until it was no longer oil based and went automated, and then that was it. So that lighthouse has always been a bit of a symbol for myself, and also of that unspoiled, protected Ibiza, where suddenly coming out from the harbor of San An and arriving there and feeling all that silence where all you hear is the seagulls is simply incredible. You feel so at peace immediately and so in awe of those changing colors of the water. We get blues, greens, then the Posidonia patches. It's like a perfect drawing.
Well, we're going to be doing a little sunset series this summer, just to get our little advert in there, yes. Which I'm very excited about hosting some sunset sessions. I've always, always wanted to do that on this island somewhere. I used to host sunrise sessions as a yoga teacher in the not too distant past. And so this feels like I'll be coming full circle on the wonderful boat that you've got this season. And we're going to be having some live conversations, and people can check those out on the episode show notes to see what dates that we're going to be doing those. And we are finalizing the guest list in terms of the speakers as well as we speak. So do keep your eye on the link. And thank you so much for joining me and inviting me, more importantly, down to Calicomptre, which I've never come to, and I've forgotten how ridiculously gorgeous it is. And I'm very happy to have come down and witnessed this aquamarine beauty that's been reflecting in your big blue eyes, Gregory.
Thank you, Joe. And thank you, not just from me, but on behalf of many people in this island. We love the work that you do. We love it, exactly that you're a beacon of what Ibiza should be, you know, to put a microphone. I'm not saying for myself, but for others who really have very interesting things to say about alternative ways of looking at the world and feeling comfortable doing so with you. So very much looking forward to doing this series on the boat as well. We're looking for people who love the Sea of Ibiza, who want to advocate the importance of protecting the most important good that we have in Ibiza and the reason where it all started, the sea. And perhaps mixing their own personal story as business owners in Ibiza, artists, musicians, DJs, who want to say, look, we need to protect this and we need to do a better job. And hopefully we can create something nice at sea. And I'm sure that with you, we will.
I have no doubt either with you. So I'm very excited. Thank you so much for joining me here on The Reset Rebel.
Thank you, Joe.
Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel.